Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth. I'm Brady Carlson, in for Virginia Prescott. It takes a certain kind of person to volunteer for active duty in a war zone, but what about those signing up to fight bygone battles of another era? What drives individuals to spend countless hours and dollars reenacting wars of the past, which have fixed outcomes? To find out, Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Nick Kowalczyk, professor of writing at Ithaca College and war correspondent of sorts. He covered a reenactment of the Siege of Niagara, a battle from the French and Indian War, in a story for Salon.com called Embedded with the Reenactors. Taylor caught up with Nick at a Cornell University studio, where he explained the importance of the trappings of history to a war reenactor.
Period dress has to be 100% authentic for a reenactor to be taken seriously by other reenactors. A lot of the people who make the clothing will travel to places like Williamsburg and research how the clothes were actually put together. Other reenactors that get the bad nickname docu-Nazis, who are kind of considered the authenticity police, who kind of hawk and watch other reenactors, you know, based on the authenticity of their outfits. It's incredibly expensive. I mean, a shirt that looks like kind of bad pajamas today could cost a reenactor $75. Most of the clothing will be purchased online through specific vendors. Reenactors try to find as many old journals from whatever time period. And they'll also think really hard about who their character is. So if, let's say, I'm impersonating one of the Rogers Rangers from the French and Indian War, I need to go back and look up, like, what would he have worn? What would he have carried in the woods? And do my best to get it right.
Okay, so what about guns or muskets? I mean, I assume that's a big part of it, too. Those replicas, are some people using actual antiques?
They're replicas, but they still cost, you know, $1,000, $2,000, perhaps even $3,000. And the gun is the major purchase.
And I assume it has to work. I mean, they don't just sort of point guns at each other and say bang and fall down.
No, yeah, it has to work, and it has to be well cleaned. When I sort of embedded myself with a group of reenactors, the battle began, and I was standing next to one guy who he forgot to clean his gun before the reenactment started. And because his gun wouldn't work, he had to play dead. And at the same time, someone asked us, commanding general, are you guys dead? And we said, yes. And he said, can you be dead over there? Because we're moving in this direction.
So the two of you, corpses, got up.
We got up and moved.
Yeah. That reenactment that you took part in outside of Buffalo, New York, the Siege of Fort Niagara, a battle from the French and Indian War. You mentioned in your essay reenactors call it the F&I War.
The F&I War.
Any other popular anachronisms among the reenactor community?
Well, you mean like the language that they use?
Sure, yeah. I mean, obviously, if they call it the F&I War, they're more familiar with it than the average American, I would say, who doesn't know about the French and Indian War, never mind reenacts it.
I mean, any reenactor who chooses a given time period really becomes obsessed with that time period, and it's really kind of its own subculture. I didn't know, for instance, that reenactors would call a basic coffee pot, you know, a boiler. But that's the same phrase that I heard being used again and again. Reenactors also share the word Farby, and this is across all reenacting time periods. Farby meaning far be it for me to tell you that your buttons are inaccurate, but they are. And that's a word that's used by Civil War reenactors, French and Indian, Revolutionary, all the way up to World War II reenactors, and say that anybody who isn't authentic is a Farb.
So you think one of the biggest motivating factors for the average reenactor is history? They're big history buffs.
Yeah, that's one of them, yeah. I mean, they're kind of addicted to history. Every reenactment period, from my understanding, and I'm, of course, no tremendous expert, but they all share similar things. Like, they do it mostly for themselves and not for the public, despite what we may think. You know, there's a battle reenactment going on to commemorate X battle, so the public shows up. And the reenactors are there to do that battle, but they're also there mostly just to hang out amongst themselves, and they're happiest when the public isn't around. Hmm. It's kind of their way of participating in history, and the public's entertainment is just sort of a side thing. And the other value, of course, is authenticity.
It's funny because it sounds to me, the way you put it, that to be a reenactor or a part of being a reenactor really is, for lack of a better phrase, living in the past. I mean, did you meet anybody or talk to anybody that was connecting history to modern politics or talking about, you know, the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan?
It's my sense that reenactors aren't asking those kinds of questions. They're here to celebrate America rather than to think about America. They're not liberal progressives. It's very much a white conservative hobby.
But you also sort of point out that a lot of reenactors are bringing their families. It's sort of a family event. What are they doing this whole time? Are they just lounging at a nearby hotel or?
No. So the men go off to battle and they do their drills. The women are relegated to staying back in the camp. They spend pretty much their entire day cooking over the campfire and preparing the meal, cleaning up after the meal, knitting, talking. They can't read a book because that would be outside of the given time period. The children, when they're young, they're brought out onto the battlefield usually. Some of the older ones that I met, they actually keep dipping out every couple of hours to go off and smoke pot and then come back and they're stoned and participating on the battlefield.
Now, is that a historical accuracy or?
You mean were the teens of the 18th century getting high? I don't know. I'm not sure. I remember there's that line from Dazed and Confused where they said something about George Washington growing pot. So maybe.
Maybe it was all part of the plan.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned a couple times that, you know, there's a script that's being followed. Where does the script come from? Obviously history wrote the script, but who wrote the script?
The battles follow what happened in history for the most part. The Siege of Fort Niagara actually took about a month, and the event was condensed into 3 days. The way reenactments are organized is that there are companies that are by state and then battalions. There might be a level above the battalion, and whoever is kind of the highest will be part of the people who decide how the event flows and what happens when and what the timing is like. And it really is a huge organizational process. In the instance of Fort Niagara, they had 2,500 reenactors there that year. So Figuring out where people sleep, you know, how the troops are going to move to avoid being seen by the public before they arrive in the battlefield, where the artists are going to be, where the settlers' camp is going to be, it takes a lot of planning.
And getting to the actual battle, I know there's a lot of lead up to the battle. You know, you talk about the camp, you talk about meeting various reenactors, and then you finally get to the battle. Can you give me a little bit about your initial impression? Can you sort of describe the atmosphere?
So to get to the battle, we had to walk first across a 4-lane divided highway and through some woods along like cliffs near Lake Ontario. And as we got closer, I kept hearing the crack of the muskets. Saw smoke. We came out of the tree line, and I immediately saw a bunch of picnic tables and barbecue grills and some reenactors carrying the, you know, so-called wounded reenactors off of the battlefield. And we kind of advanced in a line. The men fired. Whenever anyone's gun stopped firing, they played dead, and then we just kind of kept advancing. I mean, it was, I don't know what it was like to fight in the 1700s, but this was very, very orderly, non-chaotic, very scripted. A lot of the reenactors would shout huzzah whenever they fired their weapons. Other ones were kind of making jokes. There was one commander who cracked a line from Stripes, which was something Harold Ramis says, which is, if we ever get ourselves in heavy combat, I'll be behind you guys all the way, or something like that, you know. There was one particular reenactor. He looked at me because I was laying on the ground taking notes, and he asked me if I was scared. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, I didn't think you would be. And then the French fired another round at us, and he says, turns to me and says, that was a close one, Nick. And it wasn't an ironic statement. Like, he seemed to really be there.
Nick Kowalczyk there, professor of writing at Ithaca College and the brave journalist behind Embedded with the Reenactors. He was talking with Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby. You can find a link to Nick's story, as well as more about the Siege of Niagara, both real and reenacted, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, Ask the Pilot, everything we've ever wanted to know about air travel straight from the source. That's when Word of Mouth continues.